It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we find out what's behind the new wave of South Korean pop culture success stories, like the hugely popular Gangnam Style.
But first, Wisconsin's been criticized for racial disparities in education and the justice system. Now there's new evidence showing a disparity in life expectancy, too.
Across the country, whites are expected to outlive blacks. The discrepancy has been closing over time, but here in Wisconsin, the gap actually grew.
Jay Kaufman joins us now. He's the Canada Research Chair in Health Disparities in the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health at McGill University. He's co-author of the study published in the Health Affairs Journal. Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we focus on Wisconsin, can you give us an overview of age disparities and how they're changing across the United States?
In disparities in mortality, racial disparities in mortality?
That's right.
We compared death rates in 1990 and every year up until 2009. And in general, disparities decreased. They shrank by about 3 years for men and about 2 years for women overall across the country. But there was a great deal of difference from state to state. The greatest disparity was in the District of Columbia, as a matter of fact, and that remained roughly stable over time. Wisconsin was notable because it was the one state where disparities actually got worse over that period.
And how much worse did those disparities get here in Wisconsin?
It was for women that there was the most notable change, and that disparity actually increased by about black women and white women. So the life expectancy for white and black women in 1990 was about 80 years and 75 years for white and black women in 1990. It changed in 2009 to about 82 years and 75.7 years for black women. So that gap between the women actually increased by about 1.5 years.
Stepping away from the gap for a bit, is the general story that we're all black and white living a bit longer across the nation and here in Wisconsin?
Yes, mortality rates fell in every state and for every group, but when some rates fall faster than others, then the disparity can increase or decrease, depending on which group is gaining faster or slower.
And I want to talk a little bit, if you'll bear with me, about the statistics here. Is it possible when we break this down state by state that maybe a state with a very small African-American population, it can skew the results a little bit? A small change in a small population can look pretty big when we start talking percentages.
Absolutely. That's true. And there are a number of states like Alaska, Hawaii, where we have somewhat unstable measures of the disparities. And so we don't attach a lot of confidence to those. But Wisconsin actually has a relatively large black population, and so the estimates are pretty precise for Wisconsin.
Now, I know your study doesn't go into the causes and effects here. You're kind of measuring the mortality and letting people take it from there. But are there things that states are doing differently that might account for better results elsewhere than here in Wisconsin?
Well, that's a speculative area because we didn't really study social policies directly. That's really the next thing that we should start looking at is the specific causes of death that account for these changes and the specific age groups that are doing better and worse and specific policies that might begin to account for those things. We can speculate. We have hypotheses about some of the differences between states, but our paper can't really definitively make any statements about that.
Right.
I can throw out one hypothesis if you want to entertain
that. Please do, yeah.
One state that did particularly well over this period was New York State. Also has a very large black population, and that population gained in life expectancy much greater than the national average. Whites also gained in New York State, but blacks gained more quickly, and so their disparities fell more rapidly than any other state. One thing that New York did over this period of time was reduce its prison population tremendously. And Wisconsin is notable for having the largest proportion of its African Americans in prison compared to any other state, about twice the national average.
Interesting. So starting with the research that we're talking about, what are the next avenues you think people might want to research? Obviously, what you just mentioned about prison populations would be one area worthy of further study. What else would you like to see as people try to tease out the cause and effect in the gap in mortality?
Some obvious hypotheses have to do with access to medical care and social programs for mothers and children, educational opportunities, employment opportunities, nutritional opportunities. All of these things contribute to healthy life expectancy, and so all of them are possible explanations for the changes we see over time.
And is there anything that you think health officials, I know there's more research to be done, but that health officials, maybe even state governments, can look at your data and start doing, or at least looking at doing now?
Well, for women, which are the women were the group in Wisconsin who fared worse, and that difference really appeared most strongly in the age groups around 50, 55, 60 years of age, where black women were dying of chronic disease at rates that were increasing over time, where whites were decreasing in those age groups. And we know from similar analyses that the disparities between black and white women are largely due to common chronic diseases like diabetes, coronary disease, cancers like breast cancer that are common. And so the screening and the treatment for these kinds of conditions are going to account for a lot of the disparity.
Now, are we in the United States unique in having this kind of measurable race or ethnicity-based health disparity, or are there comparable stories up there in Canada or elsewhere in the world that you've looked at?
It's an interesting problem in Canada. We don't have race on the vital statistics, on the death certificates, so we can't look as easily in Canada at this disparity. It's one thing that we're trying to do in Canada right now to try to find sources of information that will let us know about that. We certainly have socioeconomic disparities, and those have been noted in many other countries. And there have been many studies in Europe and in Latin America about socioeconomic disparities. The United States is somewhat unique in its particular attention to race as a way of dividing the population socially and statistically. It seems quite plausible that other countries are going to have hierarchies, social hierarchies, and maldistribution of resources and opportunities for care and screening, and probably will have other similar disparities.
Jay, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Jay Kaufman, Canada Research Chair in Health Disparities at McGill University.
Open Gangnam Style.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Just 5 months after Korean rapper Psy's quirky dance video Gangnam Style exploded on YouTube, it hit 1 billion, that's a B, views, the most watched video ever.
And as of May of this year, it doubled that record to 2 billion, with a B, views. The success of Gangnam Style is just one example of how South Korea has remade itself into a 21st century powerhouse in business, technology, and even the arts.
Is South Korean pop culture conquering the world? With us is Yuni Hong. She's a journalist and author of the new book, The Birth of Korean Cool. She grew up in both Chicago and Seoul's Gangnam neighborhood. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Yuni, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, we played Gangnam Style, but that is really the tip of the iceberg. We're just seeing a little bit of this Korean cool here in the United States. How big a force is South Korean popular culture around the globe right now?
Right. Well, actually, it's taken off across the globe far, far more than we are able to see in the U.S., just because the U.S. historically, for obvious reasons, has produced its own entertainment. But, you know, we're seeing things that would have been unimaginable just a few years ago, like households in Iran planning their entire meal time so that they can make sure that they are free to watch their favorite Korean dramas. We have Cuba, with whom South Korea does not even have diplomatic relations, addicted to Korean dramas. And what people don't seem to realize is that a lot of this is backed and paid for and supported by the Korean government. The fad is real, but it got a very helpful early start with public funds.
And I didn't realize this until reading your book. Talk about how the South Korean government, along with the business community, has made it a really overt goal to export South Korean culture.
Yes. Well, basically what happened was after the Asian financial crisis of 1997, South Korea realized that it was overly dependent on its big conglomerates like Samsung and Hyundai. They decided that they had to diversify the nation's revenue in revenue sources. And for some reason, they came up with this crazy idea of becoming the world's largest exporter of pop culture. But it sounds like they actually might have known what they were doing.
So crazy it just might work, it sounds like.
Well, yes. And one of the things that they realized is, okay, well, our language, Korean, is only spoken in one country. We can't just expect people to watch our TV shows and listen to our songs. We're going to have to really make this as plug-and-play for everyone as possible. So what do I mean by that? I mean, for example, that the Korean government subsidized and continues to subsidize the translation of K-dramas, of Korean dramas, into other languages so that all the local network has to do is really press play. And they don't really have to do anything. In early stages of this, the Korean government even secured ad time so that the local network would not have to even take the trouble of hitting the pavement to sell ads.
And that's just part of it. Also, there's a big connection between the technology and the culture. You talk about South Korea being very forward-thinking as far as wiring and internet connections around the country.
Well, exactly. In the 90s... again, after the financial crisis, the president at the time, whose name was Kim Dae-jung, decided, well, we have this new technology, the Internet, the World Wide Web, and everyone is on a level playing field. We don't have to play catch-up if we decide that we are going to be number one in this area, if we are the number one most wired country in the world. We can actually achieve this, and it's realistic. And that's exactly what they did. They laid down fiber optic cables all over the country, and they currently have close to 100% internet penetration and the fastest broadband in the world.
Now, your story is part of this story. You grew up in both Chicago and, as we mentioned, the Gangnam neighborhood. When you moved to Korea, I think at age 12, did it seem like a cool place? Did it seem like a place ready to start exporting culture to the rest of the world?
No, it was really dreadful and uncharming. It was still very much a developing country. They were about a third of the homes in the country as a whole did not even have indoor plumbing. There were a lot of sort of widespread health problems. And it was, in those days, still very much, it was living up to its ancient nickname, the Hermit Kingdom, which was given to it by European explorers of the 18th and 19th century. And it was still very much a Hermit Kingdom when I was there.
And a lot of times when governments focus on culture, it seems like it's a means of protecting our culture from the rest of the world. So there's like Canadian content laws and all sorts of French agencies to weed out English loanwords and things like that. How unique do you think this effort is, not to protect South Korean culture, but to export it around the world?
Yeah, I think this is really the first time in the history of the world that any nation has made a collective effort to be the number one pop culture exporter in the world. It's the first non-English-speaking nation to try, and they're going at it sort of with all guns blazing on every front: music, movies, food, video games, which people don't realize are 11 times more profitable than K-pop. If you think K-pop is huge, Korea is actually one of the world's biggest makers of video games. So they're really going on sort of a amphibious assault. And no other country has actually done this in such a concentrated period of time.
Right. You think of United States culture being exported around the world, and there was some intent there, but some of it was just because we were a superpower with a powerful economy, not quite that sort of level of intent, of really putting together a plan and sticking with it.
Oh, exactly. I mean, certainly American media companies tried as hard as possible to export. The difference, though, is that historically America has never tried or had to really see what local markets were like or learn about them or adapt to them because America, as you say, were the heroes after World War II. They literally bailed out the free world. They gave $13 billion to Europe for the Marshall Plan. And people would automatically buy American no matter what it was.
The blue jeans just came along with the ride.
Exactly. Blue jeans, Cadillac.
The movies, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing. Rock Hudson, Doris Day, Annette Funicello. It was just something that everyone aspired to. This is no longer the world that we live in.
And you write about, and you mentioned video games, some very intentional, almost anthropological work where people in South Korea are studying, say, the Japanese language and culture to produce that video game instead of hoping that, you know, as I think you point out, American video game producers do, that people will just latch on and forgive the cultural and language differences.
No, right, exactly. I mean, Korea was very realistic. They knew that they had to sort of meet other people, not just halfway, but sort of all the way. Again, the word plug and play comes to mind, where they just say, okay, let's make the game in Japanese to begin with and make it look, for all intents and purposes, like a Japanese game. You know, it doesn't even have to have an obvious made in Korea mark on it. You know, just let's just do whatever we can to make this marketable to the local culture.
Now, you've seen the Korean educational system as a student, as well as researching your book. How does education fit into this?
Well, education, unlike in the U.S., education is actually being leveraged to bring about this pop culture, this national goal, in the sense that the nation's top minds, the government official who probably took this really difficult civil service exam thinking that they were going to be put on, you know, policies for saving the forest or something, and they're now striding themselves in the position of being put on the pop culture project, rather. And the reason they're picking the nation's best minds is that they see this very much as a science. It's the way that other countries would do, say, the Manhattan Project in a time of war, except this is something like that happening in a time of peace.
Now, we've mentioned the music, some it's made an impression in the U.S. There are also movie directors. We've had movie remakes of Korean movies, and now Korean movie directors directing original work here in the U.S. But how much does this plan care about the United States as a market? Is it about us or is it about everybody else?
That's an excellent question, because we've actually reached a point in history where it would be nice if America bought things, but you no longer need the U.S. market as a lock in order to achieve dominance in the rest of the world. The rest of the world has a lot of purchasing power, and they are actively looking for alternatives to American goods. And that's true for a number of reasons, one of which is the United States is seen as a bad political actor by much of the world, as a country that invades countries unilaterally, doesn't really care about the UN vote, and kind of forces its allies to enter wars. And they've made a lot of enemies, and I don't think a lot of people realize that this will have effects, and already has effects, on American monopoly on popular culture in the world.
You mentioned that Korean is only spoken for the most part in Korea or by the Korean diaspora, but one word is translating the word Hallyu. President Obama praised the quality of Hallyu. What is it? How does it play into the rise of Korean popular culture?
Well, Hallyu just literally means, if you translate it into English, Korean wave. And I've always said that that term is misleading, because a wave is something that's natural, you know, that comes in with the tides, whereas this is a highly orchestrated, carefully planned, I don't like to use the word invasion, but that's basically what it is.
Is this something that other countries might try to clone, to replicate, or is this going to be a uniquely Korean phenomenon?
Well, there are aspects of it that they can replicate, like the 13-year slave contract, by which K-pop artists are recruited at a young age. It's actually similar to the Bolshoi Ballet or Romanian gymnasts. They pick them at a young age, and they train them for years before they're even allowed to perform publicly. I mean, that's something that people have done, and it's very effective. But one thing that makes Korea unique that is not very easily reproducible is that it is the only capitalist liberal democracy in the world that basically runs like a command economy, which is to say that the government and private business cooperate in a way that would be impossible in the United States.
We'll leave it there for now. Yuni, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was Yuni Hong. She's a journalist. Her new book is The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture.
More big news out of the media world today. Following a similar business move last week involving Scripps and Journal Communications, media giant Gannett announced that it is spinning off its broadcasting and digital businesses from its publishing division.
That means USA Today and more than 80 other newspapers will form the backbone of a new publishing company, while more than 40 TV stations and a handful of websites will make up the other, probably more profitable, company.
Joining us now to talk more about the spinoff and its implications is Ken Doctor. He is a news industry analyst who runs the websites Newsonomics.com. He is the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So we mentioned the deal between Journal and Scripps here in Wisconsin last week. I didn't mention Tribune Publishing and now Gannett. Are these, first of all, the timing is interesting on these, but are these all basically the same deal?
They are similar. They all come out of the very central idea that financially newspaper assets are distressed. We've seen an industry that really hasn't grown in 7 years, hasn't grown any revenues in 7 years. And it's increasingly clear that the financial markets don't like these investments. So if you run a company like Tribune or Gannett, and you have both broadcast stations and you have newspapers, the markets want you to split them up. They want to invest in the broadcast part, even though that's got some struggles of its own, but nothing compared to newspapers. So that's what we're seeing across the board here. News Corp did it last year, and it is near complete at this point with Gannett's announcement today.
And I have to tell you, you know, if you've been following media for the past couple of decades, this idea of synergy or whatever you want to call it, where everything is sort of combining into one, all of a sudden that idea seems like it's right out the window.
Exactly. And it's funny because that was a religion of its kind within the industry, say, 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, you know, video's coming, and if we could get these newspaper companies to do video, and the broadcasters would say, you know, I've got all these people that know how to do film, but they don't know how to write. And so you had companies come together, and Tribune was one of them. Gannett was one of them. So, well, we have all these skills in our company, and we can put them together. And you're right, that magic word was synergy. But it's one of those words the CEOs like to use, and operationally very, very tough to get done. And now it is out the window.
So let's talk about what's happening with Gannett. A lot of people, of course, know Gannett as USA Today, but in terms of newspapers, in terms of the broadcast side, there's a lot more to it than that. Tell us what the new deal looks like, what these two new companies look like.
So on the new company, which is still unnamed, it is broadcast and it is digital. So broadcast, in that Gannett now is among the top three broadcasters in the country, and that would be in terms of local regional stations, not national ones, depending how you count. They just made a major purchase last fall of Belo TV that propelled them into that top three. And the broadcast industry is mature, but it's still growing, and especially in election years, and with the Supreme Court decisions making fewer and fewer restrictions on campaign funding, they're looking for a good year this year in 2014 and a big year in 2016. So that's a more stable business that's growing, and in consolidating, they believe, once again, that scale will work in that business. They also have in that business digital businesses, classifieds, you're looking for a job, career builder. And today they made the announcement, the same time they announced their split, that they were buying the rest of Cars.com, which is one of the two biggest car sites in the U.S. of finding new cars and some used cars as well. So that is a broadcast digital company set up pretty well for the future, will be favored by investors. The newspaper company will be called Gannett, and that one has 81 papers. USA Today, as you said, is the one that everybody knows, but they have bigger papers in Detroit, Des Moines, Louisville, and they have, I believe, 10 papers in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a profound footprint across the country. And like most newspaper companies, they haven't grown revenue in 7 years. The big problem is print advertising, which is down about 8% a year for the last 3.5 years now. So they can't get beyond this tremendous loss of print advertising as really those dollars go to Google and Facebook. And you can draw a pretty direct line in that transition. And it's going away from the companies that produce news to companies that present news but don't produce it.
And that puts newspapers in a tough spot. So when you look at this deal or these deals as they stand now, some people are going to look at this and say, well, this is a great chance for newspapers to sort of reinvent themselves on their own terms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Other people are going to say, well, there's nothing else you can do with the newspapers, so let them go die off over there by themselves. Which way do you see it, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's fairly straightforward. The rationale for these deals is purely financial. It is the markets, and these are all public companies, the markets value the broadcast and digital highly or relatively highly, and they don't value the print for much. The question of focus has come up. It's not the reason the deals are getting done. But if you are a smart CEO like Jack Griffin, the guy who takes over the new Tribune publishing business today, in fact, when it goes out on the New York Stock Exchange, you use that motivation and you say, it's almost like a football coach in a locker room and say, you know, boys, this is our chance. We're standalone. We got our own future to chart. We don't have to worry about those other guys anymore. Let's go do it. So it's not the reason for it, but you can use it that way.
But how much time do they have to prove their case?
Years, still. The key question has been, is the newspaper industry going to die? And the real sad answer, and I'm someone who has worked in newspapers, or did work in newspapers for many years, is that it's dying. 30% of the journalistic workforce of newspapers is gone over the last 7 years in the U.S. So it is dying, yet it is still profitable. These companies still make 5 to 10% profits a year. So what it's about from a business point of view is managing decline, and it turns out you can manage decline for years. You can't manage it for decades, but you can manage it for years. And in some ways, the financial decline has moderated, but they're still not turned around. They're still not growing revenue. They're getting closer in a lot of ways. They're down to 2 to 3% negative on revenue, which isn't good, but it's better than 5% or 7% where it was for some of these companies. So they're doing some positive things on the business side. They're getting more reader revenue through these all-access paywalls, but there is no playbook for growth at this point.
So what does this mean for the average consumer of news? Are they got more to look forward to, or just a really complicated environment for a while?
The big problem is local. Nationally, the economics of digital publishing are pretty good, and we're seeing all kinds of startups and a lot more national news and national discourse. I'm not really worried about that. On a local level, and most of us depend on local newspapers to generate most of the news, in truth, we're getting a lot less than we got 5 or 10 years ago, and we continue to get less. It's interesting, there are outlets like public radio, public media outlets, that become increasingly important because they have the same kind of values that newspapers have in terms of public service. And we're seeing, but we're only seeing it in the bigger cities, of say 10 bigger cities, of more investment in public media. A station in L.A., KPCC, for instance, now has 100 journalists working for it. So it's very uneven locally. We're poorer for the coverage locally all across America. Some newspapers, the ones that are family-owned or the ones that are privately owned, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, John Henry the Boston Globe, they tend to be supporting these papers and looking at them as long-term and not cutting staff.
And we'll have to leave it there. Ken, thanks so much for being here today.
Quite welcome.
Ken Doctor is a news industry analyst and the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get.
Next week, primary elections take place across the state of Wisconsin. They'll determine who's going to go on to the midterms in early November. All this week on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show, we're bringing the primary contenders in a variety of races to you in a series of candidate forums. Yesterday, we talked with the candidates in Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District in the Milwaukee area. Now we head north and meet the candidates in the 7th District. The seat is currently held by Sean Duffy, who's facing a primary challenge from a fellow Republican. There are two Democrats vying for the office as well. We extended an invitation to Representative Duffy to talk with us on the show. He was unable to join us. We turn now to his primary opponent, Don Rahala. He is a small business owner and a Republican candidate in that 7th Congressional District primary election. He joins us from our studio in Superior. Don Rahala, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon.
So, start with the basics. Why are you running for Congress?
I think every candidate pretty much has the same answer. They're just dissatisfied with what's going on in Washington. And with me in particular, it's with Sean Duffy. I don't believe he's conservative enough. I know the Democrat candidates will argue the other way, that he's, you know, not moderate enough or not Democrat enough. But I believe he's not conservative enough, and I think his voting record shows that.
Can you tell us a little more before we get into some issues about your background?
I'm 46. Do you want my whole details? I'm 46. Never married, no kids. Just living the single life. I run a real estate office. I do a lot of property management, and I've been in sales, customer service. I was an accountant. At my alma mater right now at UWS. I graduated in 1990 with a BA in accounting and finance.
And you ran for this office in 2010 as a Democrat. On your website, you say, I was a conservative then, I'm a conservative now. Can you flesh that out so people know, you know, you ran as a Democrat then, a Republican now, so people know what they're getting?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. In 2010, I did not run as a Democrat. I ran on the vehicle, the Democrat ticket. Sean Duffy came out early in 2009, and, you know, the guy had like 1.5 million before 2010. So I was set to go against Dave Obie, and he obviously got out of the race. But I'm not foolish enough to go up against 1.5 million. That's just not going to work. So I thought, what the heck? I'll just go with the same message, what I already prepared website wise and everything like that. All my messages, got all those ducks in orders, and just went as a Democrat just to see, or on the Democrat ticket just to see, you know, what it's like for experience.
Well, Sean Duffy is the incumbent now, still with mainstream party support. Why go as a Republican this time around?
Well, because that's where I am. I'm fiscally conservative, and I'd probably say on the social side, I don't necessarily care what people's social issues are, and I don't expect them to care what my social issues are. If a vote comes down to whether an issue is or not supported by the Constitution, then it doesn't get an upvote. You know, I would never instill my beliefs and my values on my constituents, and that's where I stand on that. So I'm fiscally conservative, and I think that's the way our country has to go, the route our country has to go to fix our fiscal mess.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing that part of the state, the 7th District?
I think the biggest problem, I just read a Forbes article that there are over $2 trillion being held by our businesses, our major manufacturing, and, you know, they're afraid to expand. They're afraid to invest money, and that's why we're in such a jam right now. Our economic system has kind of come to a standstill. They don't know what's going on. We have President Barack Obama in office, and he seems to be dictating, you know, the way this country goes with or without Congress. So I think just the insurety of where our country head is, that's the primary reason why our economy is coming to a halt.
Well, part of the problem, people have said, is the gridlock in Congress, not necessarily one party or another, but divided control. Do you think if you are still in a divided Congress, say a Democratic Senate, a Republican House, that you could help reach across that gridlock and get something done?
Yeah, I do believe in that's what I do as a real estate broker. I bring two parties together for a satisfactory solution. That's what a broker does. That's what a congressman has to do. I think part of the problem here comes when you have bills that are going to the floor, thousands of pages long. Obviously, nobody's reading these. Nobody has time to understand it. And that's where you have the deadlock. You know, Republicans want to send their message through, Democrats want to send their message through, and you got these massive bills, and there's just no wiggle room at all. So I think you just have to start out small, have small issues, and solve it piecemeal at a time. So.
Well, related to the jobs and business investment issue you touched on there, a big issue facing your part of the state, of course, is the proposed iron mine up there. It's a state issue in many ways, but the federal government, the EPA, among other things, will have a lot to say in the issue. What is your take on the mining issue?
I'm for mine. We need those jobs up in northern Wisconsin. That's you know, that the numbers keep fluctuating, whatever it is. I mean, you know, give or take around 1,000 somewhere. We need those good paying jobs up here, as long as it's done right. I mean, of course, we have to respect our environment and do it correctly. So I don't know why there's such a big hang-up. There's thousands of mines in this country, and I don't know why this one is causing all the hang-up. It should be uniform. So this mine in particular doesn't have anything different than a mine, say, in Minnesota. I've been to the mines, the old mine pits in Minnesota. I've hiked up there. I've biked up there. I've fished up there. It's great. You know, these companies are leaving them in great shape when they're done. I mean, we're a global economy. We need to pull these resources out. And if it's northern Wisconsin, then it's going to be in northern Wisconsin. So it just has to be done smartly.
The local critics of the proposed mine and critics around the state say, well, there are unique water quality problems we're worried about. We are worried that it'll affect the tourism. It won't make it a good place to visit and hike, as you were just saying about the areas in northern Minnesota. You don't share that concern?
You know, I guess if it's in my own backyard, I'm sure you're way more concerned. If we were to go there right now and talk, I'm sure you'd have people with stronger opinions than mine. But like I said, we are a global economy. This isn't just a Republican stance. This is a Democrat stance. We're a global economy. We need these resources to keep all our economies going. It needs to be done smartly, and I don't see a difference. I don't understand. I'm on the border, so most of my news is about what I see through the media comes from Minnesota, and there's just really no difference. So it's just it's a mine in Wisconsin, basically. That's the only difference. So the same concerns are done in Minnesota, and it's done smartly. So,
turning away from some of the things specific to your district to some national issues, let's get into the federal budget a little more. You mentioned you're a fiscal conservative. What things would you like to see change to make a more fiscally conservative federal government?
We have to be consistent. That's the biggest thing here. We can't, and I'll pick on Sean Duffy because his voting record supports that. You can't vote for bills or hold back on, you know, vote balanced budget 1 year and then vote unbalanced budget next year. Of course, they've always been unbalanced budgets recently, but you have to be consistent. These are hard decisions coming down the pipe. You need somebody in there that's going to say, no, we can't save money on this project and then dump money on another project. So it's got to come down to hard decisions and complete consistency to get this job done.
And what would that mean for something like taxes?
I believe we're taxed enough. I mean, I'm not a Tea Party guy, taxed enough already, but I think everyone pays their fair share. I'd like to see the solution come more on the spending side, taking a LIFO accounting type approach. Last in is the first out. I mean, obviously, these problems have garnered steam through Bush and now into Obama. So we have to work our way back. What's least important to the American population is the first that needs to be cut first.
Well, one of the biggest issues in the last midterm election was the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare. As a congressman, what would you want to see happen to that? Tweaks, modifications, total repeal?
The whole bill itself does not stand in piecemeal form. So obviously now they're talking about getting rid of the subsidies because the subsidies are unconstitutional. Therefore, the whole system collapses. The whole bill collapses. It's $2.7 trillion now over 10 years. That's the cost. That's way too much. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm a repeal guy. Let's get rid of it. Secondly, it steps on everybody's First Amendment religious rights. And with abortion, with everybody paying for abortion, and I'm not for that, so that's got to go. And I think everybody wants their opinions, their stance on abortion protected, so.
And then one big issue Congress left on the table at the end of the session last week, immigration, the border crisis, lots of Central American youth detained there. What would you like to have seen come out of Congress and get signed by the president?
We're like a sinking ship there. I mean, now you're talking about Ebola people, people with Ebola coming over the border. This is not just a Central American country with their immigrants coming to our country. This is, if you look at the documents coming out of there, there are literally people from all over the world coming through that border into our country. And now they're talking about people with Ebola that might be coming through that way. And that's just, you know, it's not a war, but it's got the consequences of a war. We have to have strong borders, and then that's the first part. You can't have amnesty without a strong border. You obviously can't declare amnesty, because if you do first without having a secured border, you're going to get millions of people through, and someone's going to be paying for that, and that's going to be me and you.
Your final message to voters before I let you go.
I have a very simple message. It's just complete clarity. Know what your candidate stands for. I'm not necessarily saying vote for me. I'm saying make sure the candidate you are voting for is going to represent you and your values, because obviously our country is taking a different direction. I just want to make sure people have that choice. I put up 34 issues on my website, www.votefordon.com, and hopefully they take a look at me and consider me as a candidate.
Don Rahelas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Don Rahela. He's a small business owner. He's a Republican candidate challenging Sean Duffy in Wisconsin's 7th congressional primary election.